Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about really the evolution of consciousness, the evolution of culture, and kind of a new history, I would say, a retelling of the true history of the planet, of civilization. And that's why I'm talking tonight to Marshall Clearfield. He will be one of the featured speakers at Contact in the Desert coming up this June, June 3rd to the 5th at Joshua Tree, California. Go to the Joshua Tree Retreat Center or go to contactinthedesert.com. Marshall, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Alan. I'm a pleasure to be speaking to you.
Yeah, Contact's always a lot of fun, isn't it?
Oh, it's my fourth year up there, Alan, and I called it originally the Woodstock of the UFOs.
Well, you're the one who said that. Oh.
Yeah, that's my quote, my soundbite.
Oh, that's your? Because it really is. It really is. And you know, I think what you're saying to me, your specialty is really the Anunnaki, the ancient
civilization. That's right. I've written many books about them, and I relied on the giant database that Zachariah Sitchin unveiled for us from the Sumerian cuneiform tablets and cylinder seals.
Right. So the Anunnaki, as I understand it, was, I mean, there's lots of different versions, an ancient race of beings that came here, changed our DNA, enslaved us, helped us mine for gold. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, I got a lot of versions of who the Anunnaki are and when they're here and what they did. Could you kind of lay that out and then we'll go into more detail?
Yes, I rely basically on what the Sumerians wrote about them. You see, the amazing thing about the Sumerian civilization, Alan, is that they appeared to have arrived complete with every of the 100 firsts that are necessary for a civilization. They had writing, they had the wheel, they had philosophy, they had physics, the arts, music, and cities with streets laid out and plans, and they had high-rise buildings. And the people who have studied them have never explained fully how that happens. You don't take a Stone Age civilization and all of a sudden have them evolve into a full-blown advanced civilization. That just doesn't happen.
Oh, so there was absolutely no development with the Sumerians. Boom, overnight, they're in cities, they have writing. That is strange. So, yeah.
It is absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. And what they said in their writings was that everything we have was given to us by the Anunnaki. So mm-hmm. the question was, who were the Anunnaki? They described them as flesh and blood beings who were very tall and who were very advanced, and that they were, at that time, like, say, 4,000 years ago, they were the lords of the. They weren't gods yet. They were just the lords, and they ruled what the Sumerians did. And the Sumerians were apparently very happy to have received all of these wonderful things. And it's like if you look back in the history of our civilizations that we've written about, we have a repetitive story of advanced civilizations encountering aboriginals, conquistadors and the Incas, for instance. And what happens is there's always a technology transfer that occurs. And every place we've seen that, it appears to be kind of a historical fact. And so I think that if we read the translations, Zechariah was able to translate over 2,000 of the scientific cuneiform tablets, and from that database he created his set of books called the Earth Chronicles. And I started a relationship with him in 1999. I discovered him, I read his first book, The 12th Planet, and was immediately delighted to find answers to questions I've had all my life. For instance, where do we come from? Is there a God? Who started the universe? All of these kind of impossible questions came into focus for me. And I studied under him for 10 years and started writing my own explanation of what I found. And then as I progressed through my research, I've uncovered some physical evidence, Alan, that I think proves beyond a doubt that the Anunnaki did exist. There's no explanation, for instance, for many of the stone structures that exist on our planet today that we would have a very difficult time recreating. For instance,
like what? Like what did they build?
Like the Egyptian pyramids. I mean, there's a first example. In Baalbek, Lebanon, there's a platform that they claimed was their landing platform where their ships came down. And there's some stones there that are remarkable. They're the largest single quarried stones on the planet Earth. They measure 64 feet long, 10 feet tall, and 14 foot wide, and they weigh over 1,200 tons.
Wow.
And there's three of them that are 36 feet in the air, placed on top of a course of other large stones that created a huge corner wall. Now, what I've done in my books, Alan, is that I don't use a lot of words. I built kind of like a Life magazine format. I have an 8.5 by 11, and I filled it with colored pictures. So when I talk about things like the pyramids and the Baalbek stones, I show pictures of them and let people make up their own minds. Let them explain to me, or better off, to themselves, how that could happen.
It's Wait, did Zachariah... did he read Sumerian? I heard he had other people translate it, and then he put it into his own words. Is that true?
No. I think in my experience was that he was able to read many languages, ancient Hebrew or Aramaic, and he translated the Sumerian cuneiform on his own.
Uh-huh.
He was a brilliant man who's been... not given the full credit, I don't think, of what he did. I think he uncovered the Rosetta Stone of our civilization. I really believe that.
I think he did, too. I mean, The 12th Planet, yeah, was the first book that opened it all up. But so who are the Anunnaki? Where did they come from? Why are they here? What did they want with us?
Okay, the translation says that over 400,000 years ago, this space-age civilization colonized planet Earth. They came here from their planet, which was captured into our solar system. The name that they gave to their planet was Nibiru, and it's the 12th planet. It was captured from outer space. It was a free-floating planet that was attracted by Neptune's gravitation, came in clockwise into our solar system and looped around our sun on its first pass, and then created a orbital path that took 3,600 years to go into great distances away from the sun and then come back in. Mm. It's an amazing story, and I think it's starting to be more verified by our scientific community, who have now noticed that there are many more planets beyond Pluto.
Wait, but is that planet still coming back every 3,600 years?
Yes, or? Yes. There's a written record, Alan, by many civilizations. The last one that reported it were the Greeks. Mm. And the Greeks called it Nemesis because its gravitational effect on planet Earth when it comes between Mars and Jupiter is severe. It causes earthquakes, tidal waves, and all kinds of difficulties on planet Earth because of the size of it when it orbits around the sun. Mm. And Zechariah deciphered seven of the cuneiform tablets, which were called the story of creation. There were seven tablets were entitled Enuma Elish, and many people read them and didn't understand them, but he was able to unravel the cosmology that was in there. And I reproduce that in my first book called Adam, the Missing Link, in which I tell the story. I asked Zechariah for permission to make a simple explanation of his writings by pictures and Life magazine format, and he said, as long as you give me credit for what you print with my pictures, just say by permission with Zechariah Sitchin, go right ahead.
Mm.
So I produced that first book in 2003, and then I followed it up with my second book called Gilgamesh 10, which was a screenplay format of the first written story on the planet, which is the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Right. Gilgamesh was an Anunnaki, do you feel?
Yes. No, he was two-thirds Anunnaki. Actually, his father was human. His mother was a Anunnaki queen.
Mm.
The result in their religious designation, if your mother is Anunnaki, you're two-thirds Anunnaki.
Mm-hmm. But wait, is that planet coming? When is it coming back now?
Well, the best calculation that both Zachariah and I came up with was about 1,500 to 1,600 years away. So it's the last time it was seen, and it never got full credit, was in the Roman civilization. They called it the Star of Bethlehem, but that was given another connotation. And actually, we believe that the Star of Bethlehem was the appearance again of Nibiru in the Roman sky. And if that's true, that would be like zero, and we're 2016 from there. So you subtract that from 3,600, it gives you about 1,500, 1,600 years away. But that doesn't necessarily mean, Alan, that the Anunnaki cannot come back sooner than that. Most people think it's required that the Nibiru be present in our sky before they can come down. But my analysis has given me the belief that they were living in a mothership, which was orbiting around our planet, and that when they left planet Earth, they went back to the mothership and took off and are perhaps maybe orbiting around Mercury. Now, they couldn't go back to Nibiru. They were told by Galsu, which is one of their communicators, that they had lived too long in our atmosphere and environmental gravitational fields, that if they went home to the home planet, they'd die. Mm. Now, the amazing thing that I still can't fully explain to anybody is how they lived as long as they did. It appears from the translations that they've lived hundreds of thousands of years. They aged, but so slowly that they didn't die.
Well, it seems like if their year is, let's say, 1 year is 36, you know, yeah. I mean, 100 years, that would be 1 year, you know. I mean, possibly that's an explanation of why.
Yes, that's one that Zachariah put forward, and I kind of agree that that's a distinct possibility. And I've been doing some research on my own about how we live and die, we humans, and it appears that we don't die of old age. We appear to die from disease, and if we cure all of our diseases, which apparently they were able to do, we would have a much longer life. And the Bible refers to several characters in the Bible that lived 900 years.
Right, but besides that, what I've read and heard about them, like with Inanna and some of the that they were expert geneticists, and they actually, and they manipulated our genes to be more like them. Can you talk about that?
Yes, the story from the cuneiform tablets is that about 200,000 years into their colonization of our planet, they decided that they needed a primitive worker to help them in the arduous task of mining gold. Their purpose for coming here, Alan, is clearly stated, is that they needed gold to flake into powder and put up in their atmosphere to save their planet. They were apparently had created an ozone leak in their atmosphere, and the only thing they found that would save their atmosphere was to flake it with gold, and it would reflect the rays of the sun out and heal it. So they came here. Our planet apparently was one of the places that had gold, and they started mining it. And 200,000 years into this process, they had a mutiny in their deep mining operation in Southeast Africa. And one of the leaders, the firstborn son of their king, whose name was Enki, with his sister, Nima, performed what was called a genetic engineering experiment, where they took the creature that existed on the planet at the time they were here was called Homo erectus. That's the species just before us, Homo sapiens. Right. And they took the female egg from the Homo erectus female and scooped out the nucleus and put their DNA in it and planted that egg in one of their female birth mothers. And the first Homo sapien was produced by this process, and they called that male child Adamu, firstborn male. And from there, they continued to produce more Homo sapiens, Eve, and females. And the interesting thing to me was that Zachariah was able to parallel the stories of the Anunnaki as given to us by the Sumerians with the Bible.
Right.
We, We have the story of the creation of man in the Bible, and we have the story of the creation of Homo sapiens by the Anunnaki. And he showed us the parallel between that. And I believe that we're doing that now, actually. That's a fertilization process that we use for infertile females. Mm. And it's a very, they produce the cylinder seal. Have you ever seen the cylinder seals, Alan?
No, I haven't, no.
Okay, well, this is the first printing press to me. It's a small piece of stone. It's made out of a very hard stone called hematite. And engraved in the surface of this cylinder, which is about 1 inch tall and maybe a half inch diameter, is a negative image, which when you roll that image like a rolling pin over wet clay, it gives you a positive picture.
Oh, like a print, like a printing, yeah. Right.
Yes, it's like a printing press.
Right.
Here we have, and there's 100,000 of these cylinder seals. The British Museum is just filled with them, as are the cuneiform tablets. The British Museum has a magnificent collection.
Can they read these tablets, or can they read the cylinders?
Say again?
Can they translate them?
Yes, you can go... And there are many people today besides Zachariah who were able to translate the cylinder seals. But you look at the pictures of the individuals that are shown on the cylinder seals, and you will see a remarkable, I think they're self-portraits of the Anunnaki. In fact, Zachariah's favorite seal was CV-243, which is in a German museum. It shows three Anunnaki depicting them giving a plow and a sheep shepherding to the humans. And also in the left-hand corner of that seal is a complete two-scale diagram of our solar system. Now, this seal is over 4,000 years old, and it shows the 11 planets. And one wonders, you know, to the naked eye, people 4,000 years ago could only see the four or five planets that we are able to see. And so how did they put in their Neptune and...
Uranus, right. But did Zachariah discover that that humans had a gene that didn't come from anywhere else? What was the, do you know what I'm talking about, the name of that gene? And
yes,
that it was,
yeah,
yeah, what was,
well,
that
actually I think in the year 2000 we completed the research which completely identified the 30,000 genes that compose a Homo sapien, and there were 227 foreigners in there, foreign genes that nobody could explain where they came from. So it was assumed that these were the DNA offspring that were given to us by the Anunnaki. And one of the things that I like to tell people is that if this story has validity, all the humans on this planet share the same DNA. We're all brothers and sisters under the skin, and there's no good reason for us to be killing each other.
Right, of course, that's true. So what did the Anunnaki look like? You said there's pictures of them. They were tall.
Yes, they were over 9 feet tall. They had big noses and beards and large ears, and they wore helmets with horns on them, and the horns were a designation of their rank. And people often ask me, what do they look like? Do they look like us? I said, no, we look like them. Because we are their progeny. We are the offspring. And my hope is for those who are just getting into this is that they saved our civilization once during the Great Flood. In other words, there's a story in the Epic of Gilgamesh vividly describes the Great Flood and how we were saved, humans were saved from this flood by the Anunnaki. So if they have a vested interest in saving us once, I'm hopeful, Alan, that they will save us again from ourselves, because I think we're at the tipping point in our civilization right now where we could easily destroy ourselves.
And, right. But, go ahead. Sorry. And it's true. It's true. But, you know, I'm confused because you said they came here to enslave us, make us slaves. It was this revolution. So what was the tension between Enlil and Enki, and what came down with that whole competition and freedom?
Okay, well, as they evolved, they had their own civilization. They had their own cities in what is described as Mesopotamia. Before the flood, there were major civilizations that were all Anunnaki. There were no humans at that time. And what happened was that those cities were wiped out during the flood. And following the flood, the story that you have to really ask yourself, if you read the Bible story, biblical story of Noah and the Ark, you've got to realize that the result of the flood, which was a giant tsunami, 1,000-foot-high wave that covered the earth with mud. Now, if you got 10 miles thick mud over all the surface of the earth, how can humans possibly survive? And the story in the Epic of Gilgamesh is that they brought down domesticated wheat, they brought down animals, they brought down trees, they brought down all the necessary pieces of survival for humans. That we were given life and survivability by the Anunnaki, or we would have all died. Left alone on a mud-covered surface, you cannot survive. The animal, the fish in the sea would have survived, but all living things on the surface of the planet would have died without food.
So they kind of restarted civilization. They rebooted
They got it started over again, yeah. And the evolution of the two brothers, the firstborn was Enki and the secondborn was Enlil, they had clans that followed them, and their offspring kind of got to warring against each other. And the battle between them was for supremacy of the planet Earth. And in the Bible, there's a story of Sodom and Gomorrah. And if you read the description of Sodom and Gomorrah, it sounds like an atomic destruction of those two cities. Mm-hmm. And the story in the cuneiform tablets is that they had 7 atomic weapons, which their offspring, not them, not Enlil, not Enki, but their sons, used in a war against each other, and they destroyed the launch platform that the humans were trying to build, and some people believe that was a Tower of Babel. Mm. And they also destroyed the sinful cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. And so there are many stories, not only in the Mesopotamian civilization, but in the Indus Valley, of similar warfares where violent weapons of mass destruction were in use.
But where are they now? Where's NK and Enlil now?
I believe in my research, Alan, that they're on the mothership and that they're orbiting, say, Mercury, and that they will come back. They're observing us. I think many of the UFO sightings that people record are observation and probes that they're using to see how we're doing. And there have been stories of some of our missile silos being deactivated by a flyby of UFOs. So they have the ability to neutralize our destructive arsenal to prevent us from mass destruction. I believe, Alan, that they have a vested interest in our survival. Unfortunately, we inherited in their DNA 3 of their most prominent features. One of them is that they were oversexed. The second was that they loved to make war, and the third was that they sought gold. And I look at our civilization, and I say, wow, that's us.
Mm. But didn't Enlil want to free the humans and Enki enslave them? I mean, wasn't there that tension?
Well, actually, they wanted primitive workers. They needed some workers. And then they found us to be very useful for household duties and all kinds of menial labor. We were primitive workers. You could call it slaves. But basically, we became very desirable for an advanced civilization that was doing all the labor themselves to replace their heroes, as they call themselves, to do these menial tasks. And then eventually they transferred, as we see in the Sumerian civilization, technology to enable us to grow and advance on our own. And I believe that that's what happened. And I think that one of the proofs that I have challenged the scientific community with, I've challenged them several times in my books, was that the species before us, Alan, was a creature. Homo erectus was walking around. It had hands and feet, and it had a third our brain size, but it had no vocal cords. It could not speak. Thus, it was not useful as a primitive worker. They couldn't communicate with them. And apparently 200,000 years ago, the skeletal remains of the first Homo sapiens are found in Southeast Africa, exactly where the cuneiform story tells that this experiment that created us took place. And there doesn't appear to be any skeletal remains showing the evolution of us from Homo erectus. In other words, if we did evolve directly over millions of years of evolution, there would be bunches of skeletal remains connecting us to that species, but there aren't any. And that's why I called my first book, Adam, the Missing Link. In other words, we Homo sapiens kind of appear out of nowhere, and there's no good explanation for our species other than the story that's given to us by the Sumerians in the cuneiform tablets.
Huh. Well, are there still Anunnaki on the planet now?
There is, in my belief, yes, there are. There's a story I told a couple of years ago up at the Contact in the Desert of the following World War II in 1946-47. There were reports in the Nuremberg trials by Dönitz, Admiral Dönitz, which was Hitler's supreme commander of the submarine fleet, that they had discovered a Shangri-La under the Antarctic, and they'd built a secret base there. And so Harry Truman was president in 1946. He sent an expedition to Antarctica called High Jump. And it was headed by Admiral Byrd, and the naval fleet was about 14 ships. They had an aircraft carrier, they had submarines, they had the destroyers, and their mission was to find and seek out this secret base in Antarctica and destroy it. Now, the story that has been published recently by the Russians, which they produced an hour and a half YouTube story of what really happened, was that this flotilla, which was commissioned for a six-month expedition, was attacked by flying saucers coming out of the water, and they sunk one of the destroyers. They killed many of our aviators and Navy personnel, and they blunted the task force and turned it around. And it went back after six, 7 weeks of its adventure and went back to Chile. And the story was that Admiral Byrd made a statement when he got to Chile that if the United States was faced with another continental war, it better be prepared to deal with objects that could fly from pole to pole with incredible speed. Now, what happened was that his logs and his diary have been sealed for the last 69 years by our government, and nobody got the story of what really happened. They put out a kind of a film that depicted it as an exploration of Admiral Byrd, but they never told the true story. And my question is, why has that been sealed for all these years? Why can't we get to Admiral Byrd's diary to find out what really happened down there? And if it was an attack by the Nazis, say it was a Nazi base and these flying saucers were controlled by the Nazis, I truly believe they would have killed and destroyed us completely. But the attack apparently was enough to blunt the expedition and turn it around and send it away.
Well, there is a video on YouTube of Admiral Byrd talking about flying to the South Pole and finding a beautiful open Shangri-La. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't. I'd like to see that. But the thing that is curious to me is that just recently off of Malibu, Google has found an underwater, looks like a domed encampment, which is 2.5 miles wide, a circular disc that's supported stone columns. It's not a natural formation. It looks like an underground, perhaps, UFO base. And there have been many sightings off of Malibu of this coming out of the water. They call these, Alan, USOs, unidentified submersible objects. And it's, to me, I believe that one of the sons of Enki, the bad seed son called Marduk, is still here on the planet, to answer your question about are they still here. Mm-hmm. And he's operating out of this base in the Antarctic, and that those were Anunnaki flying saucers that turned this expedition around and sent it home. Now, the truth of what's going on has been covered up by our government. I'm convinced that until we have full disclosure from our own government of what they know, we're never going to get the true story. The Russians apparently have gone public. They're now, their KGB funded this video that they put out of what really happened to Task Force 68 Operation Highland.
But also earlier you just mentioned the relationship to the Bible, and some people have talked about the worship of Jehovah, the Hebrew God, being an Anunnaki. Where does that whole religion and, you know, belief fit into?
Okay, that's a very interesting question, Alan. And I've produced an epilogue in my new book. I'm writing a new book which will come out this summer. It's called The Adventures of a Curious Mind. It's my autobiography. And in it, I will disclose the discussions that I had with Zechariah about who the Hebrew God Yahweh was. And we both came to the conclusion it was Enlil. There's so many characteristics that are fit the personality of described by the Anunnaki of Enlil and the descriptions in the Bible of the Hebrew God. And I believe that's a very distinct possibility that this Anunnaki leader wanted to separate the tribes of Israel to make them his own, that they would follow him only, they would worship only one God. You see, there was eventually the 12 leaders of the Anunnaki, which was the pantheon, evolved into gods with a small g. And we've can trace the history of these 12 throughout all of the civilizations, starting with the Sumerians all the way up to the Greeks and the Romans. And if you look at the leader gods of the Greeks, you had Zeus and Poseidon. Zeus was the commander, and Poseidon, his water brother, half-brother, was the water god. And you translate that into the Roman pantheon, you have Jupiter, the commander, and his brother, the water god Neptune. These are the same personalities of Enki and Enlil that came down to us for over 6,000 years. People worshiped these 12 deities until a new religion appeared. And I believe that the, at least I'm proposing in my epilogue to my new book, that the other deities of the major religions on the planet Earth were also Anunnaki.
I think they were. I think you're onto something. And you know what? the Ten Commandments don't say only worship one God. It actually says there'll be no other gods before me. Which
is plural. Another God. Right. Who are the other gods, Alan?
It's not saying this is the only God. It's saying worship me as the primary God, you know?
Yeah.
So,
and if you read in Genesis 6:4, they talk about the Nephilim were on the earth in those days. They were the sons of gods, and they coveted the daughters of man and had intercourse with them and created the giants of old, the men of renown. And the question is, who were the Nephilim? It's in the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they were the Anunnaki, you're saying?
I believe, yes. Zechariah and I both agreed that the reference in the Bible to the Nephilim were a description of the Anunnaki, because, you know, they were dealing with them in those days, and they had to explain some of the stuff. And there's many, many, many parallels that the stories in the Bible to the fact that there was an advanced space-age civilization occupying planet Earth, colonizing it, and that the explanation can be readily put together if you read it in the context of a space-age civilization that was able to fly from A to B. For instance, in Epic of Gilgamesh, you have this fabulous character called Ishtar. She was mm-hmm. the granddaughter of Anu, and she flies around. And of course, she seduces everybody in sight, but how was the flying princess to be explained? And finally, they found a statue in Syria, a full life-size statue of Ishtar with her space-age costume on and her helmet. And there's no explanation of to who the sculptor was, what was he looking at when he produced this magnificent replication of a fantastic female that had a space suit on.
Was Ishtar the same person as Inanna?
Yes, Inanna, and she morphs, like in the Greeks, she was Aphrodite, and in the Romans, she was Venus. Mm. And she's a main character in the story of the Epic of Gilgamesh, and we are hoping, Alan, to... we wrote the Gilgamesh 10, the second book, in a screenplay format. It's a book, but it's written as a screenplay. And we're trying to make it into a major film, which will introduce to the international audience the story of what was going on before the Bible. It's very important that I think humans understand their origins, understand the true story of how we came to be, and what our future might be.
Yeah, this completely rewrites human history. So what are the benefits of knowing the truth? How will that change us as a civilization?
Well, for one, I think we'll realize that the religious warfare, in other words, we're killing more people in the name of my God's the true God and your God isn't the true God on the planet Earth ever since the beginning of time. In other words, the surge, the purge of our civilization is that we have these multiple religions that are destroying each other. Now, if we realize that that's not really what the truth is, perhaps we would understand that we're all the same, that we all share the same DNA, and that the religious fratricide is not really what we should be doing. We should be taking care of each other. Mm. We're the only species that kills its own.
Yeah, it's strange that we're doing it. Are you saying that's because we have these Anunnaki genes in us?
Yes, well, you know, I don't know whether they did that by design or by... there are certain elements in the... They weren't perfect, Alan. They had many, many flaws, just as we do. But apparently they had a law that they couldn't kill each other. The worst thing could happen to you was you get exiled. If you did something very bad, you just got exiled out of the community. You weren't put to death.
Right, right. What, did you ever read the books of Maximilian de Lafayette? You know who he is?
Yes, I have.
He says he also reads cuneiform, and he's created a thesaurus of the Anunnaki language. It's quite fascinating. I think he expands on the... what Zachariah Sitchin did, you know, he goes further and really lays this out. And,
well, I've gone beyond Zachariah too. I wish he was still around. I could share with him the stuff I've discovered. In my last book, The Mysteries of the Alien Technology, I've discovered that many of the iconic structures on the planet couldn't possibly have been built by the locals. I'll give you an example. The first thing I came to was the Colosseum in Rome. It's built on a drained lake bed, which was Nero's lake. And underneath the Colosseum, there is a huge donut-shaped floating foundation. It's
there is
40
still,
feet deep and 110.
Today?
Pardon?
Even today, that's happening.
Well,
today,
I mean,
today
2,000 years ago, Alan, who 2,000 years ago knew about earthquake-proof floating foundations? I mean, that building has withstood earthquakes and all manner of destruction because it was not only built on a floating foundation, but it had metal joints in the upright columns that held it together to prevent lateral destruction. These are technological innovations that we have just discovered. I think there was a Japanese 60, 70 years ago that invented floating foundations because they lived in an earthquake-prone environment. And I also looked at the Pantheon. The Pantheon in Rome is over 2,000 years old. It's still standing. It has the largest unreinforced concrete dome. It's 142 foot in diameter, but it's sitting on a floating foundation. And I said to myself, you know, who knew 2,000 years ago how to build a building that would survive earthquakes and last for 2,000 years? We don't build things that last that long.
Mm-hmm.
So my new, and I went for that book, I have over 170 color pictures of many, many structures that are here on the planet that are unexplainable with the technology that, for instance, the Egyptian tools were bronze and copper chisels. And bronze and copper chisels do not put a dent in granite. You look inside the Great Pyramid in Egypt and you see polished stones, huge 70, 80 ton stones that are perfectly smooth, made out of granite. And that cannot be accomplished with bronze and copper tooling.
How did they do it? I was in the Great Pyramid. I saw those granite stones in the ceiling of the King's Chamber. Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. I also came up with the theory of what I called washboard gold mining. I was intrigued by the puzzle of what was going on inside the Great Pyramid. And I've launched a theory called washboard gold mining, and I believe that my research verifies the fact that every chamber and every tunnel inside the Great Pyramid is watertight. So I said to myself, you know, why would the architect go to the extreme requirements of producing an interior design that was watertight? I said, well, they had to use water. So I analyzed it, and I discovered that there's a pumping effect. If the water is comes down the descending passage and hits the pit. It's a pump called a hydraulic pulse pump. Before there was electricity, there was a device called hydraulic pulse pumping, which could push water higher than the level it enters by a sonic rebound. And it goes up to the Grand Gallery, and it pulses up and down in the Grand Gallery, and it eventually gets into the King's Chamber, where it floats the box. There's a granite box inside the
sarcophagus, right? The sarcophagus.
Yeah. Now, nobody's ever explained the damage to the edges of that box, Alan. If you look at the pictures of it, there's heavy damage on all the outside edges. And my theory is that that box floated during this process, and it floated around in the King's Chamber, and it banged against the walls, and it was chipped and damaged until one corner was so severely damaged that the water entered the box and it sunk to the floor. And that was the end of this process. I produced that theory in my last book, The Mysteries of Alien Technology. And I believe that I've discovered something that is awesome. I've expanded that to sites like Machu Picchu. Machu Picchu was not built by the Incas. The Incas were a Stone Age civilization, and that's a granite mountaintop that's been sculpted and built into a terraced series of terraces. And the river that goes around the base of the Machu Picchu is called the Urubamba River, is filled with placer gold. And if you pump the water up to the top and let it come over the terrace surfaces, gold is 19 times heavier than water, and it'll precipitate out onto the surfaces of those terraces, and they collect gold. What happened, in my theory, is that after the Great Flood, their deep gold mining tunnels in Southeast Africa were flooded, filled with mud, and rendered useless, so that they decided to find a new way, and they went around our planet and found the most major rivers that had placer gold, and they built structures in which they could then separate the gold from these rivers, and I call it washboard gold mining, and it's a theory that I'm challenging the scientific community to prove me wrong on.
But why did they flood the pyramid? What was the purpose of doing that?
Say again?
Why you said they flooded the pyramid, the sarcophagus floated around, hit the wall, but why was the pyramid flooded, or was that during the flood that it was flooded?
No. What happened was they built a moat around the base of the Great Pyramid, 36-foot-tall moat, so they filled it with Nile River water, and every spring, the Nile River strips the gold from the Nubian gold fields in the form of placer gold and comes down the river. And when they got it to the level of the entrance to the descending passage, it would go down the descending passage, hit the pit, and resonate through hydraulic pulse pumping up into the Grand Gallery. Now, if you look at the roof of the Grand Gallery, it's a cobbled ceiling. In effect, it's an upside-down washboard. And the water pulsed up against these ridges and bounced the gold down into the 27 slots in the floor of the Grand Gallery. And I think that the method of collecting it was sheepskins. If you read the story of Jason and the Golden Fleece, you'll see that in early history, people collected gold by putting sheepskins in placer water, and the lanolin attracted the placer particles, and it stuck to the fibers of the sheepskin and produced the Golden Fleece. So the easiest way to collect the gold was to have sheepskins in place where the gold would come down to, and that the entire inside of the Great Pyramid was a washboard gold mining operation, and I think the smoking gun, Alan, is the damaged box. Nobody's been able to explain why everything was perfect inside the King's Chamber, but here you've got a box with damage all over the edges. Why?
Wait, would that happen every year to mine the gold?
Yes, every year that flooded. And then eventually that came to an end because the box flooded when the corner was damaged, and they couldn't do that anymore, so they developed step pyramids. All over the world we have step pyramids. In Mexico there's Chichen Itza, there's Tula, there's Tiwanaku. You look at all of those, and I've pictured them and shown them in my books as placer gold mining operations. Every one of them is built next to a placer river or source of placer gold water, and I think that's an explanation of why they were built that way.
But the Grand Gallery, I mean, it's quite fascinating. In the Great Pyramid, you go through these little tunnels and suddenly it opens up into like a maybe 5-story high inner chamber that you ascend into the King's Chamber. What was the purpose of the Grand Gallery?
The Grand Gallery is a slanting tunnel with the ceiling is granite cobalt. You know, cobalt ceiling is a step pyramid upside down, if you look at it that way. So as the water surged up and down in the, I'll send you a YouTube if you give me your email address. I'll send you a YouTube which visually pictures how this thing worked, and you'd be amazed at the results that you get when you surge the water into the Grand Gallery and bang it up against the cobalt ceiling. The gold would precipitate down the walls and be collected in the 27 slots on the bottom.
Uh-huh. So how old is the Great Pyramid, according to you, and that process?
Okay. According to my research, it's over 10,000 years old. And if you look at the Egyptian civilization, there were no Egyptians 10,000 years ago.
Right. Actually, they say even John Anthony West, who was at the contact last year, said the further back you go in Egypt, the more complex their monuments are.
And, yes, absolutely. And if you look at the temple at Karnak, there's some pillars in there in the hall. There's like a forest of trees, of pillars that are magnificent, but kind of step back and say, well, who built this and how did they put those huge stones together?
Right. You know, even before Zachary Sitchin was Velikovsky, did you read Ramses II, that book, where he
yes.
makes a great case for the Sumerian was a rebirth of civilization?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, if you step back, Alan, and you take the physical facts of the irrefutable evidence that exists here on planet Earth of the stone monuments that we've credited, that our archaeologists have credited to the local civilizations that couldn't possibly have built them. But that's they don't think outside the box. You got to say that these magnificent monuments that were built by an advanced technical civilization had to be connected to something like the Anunnaki. And since we have this humongous database of information from the Sumerians about them, you put two and two together and you get four. To me, I'm a mechanical engineer. I graduated from Caltech in 1951, and I was blessed with two magnificent teachers. My physics professor was Richard Feynman.
Oh, really? Richard Feynman, the quantum physicist?
Yeah. Yes, and my chemistry professor was Linus Pauling.
Wow, those majors.
And as an undergraduate, 19-year-old kid, I was fortunate to ask them, both of them, brazen questions. I said to Dr. Feynman in a one-on-one conversation, do you believe in UFOs, Dr. Feynman? Of course, you know, I entered Caltech in 1947, so Roswell happened that year, and that's all we talked about was extraterrestrials and UFOs. And he said, Klarfeld, I believe in the law of probability. Of the hundreds of billions of stars in the Milky Way galaxy and the over 400 billion galaxies in the universe, the law of probability tells me there are 10,000 solar systems exactly identical to ours, and every one of them is older than we are. If any of those civilizations survived their space age, they could have visited us.
Mm.
Now, this was in 1949.
Wow.
And then the next year, I asked Linus Pauling if he believed in God. I was a pretty great, you know, undergraduate. And he said, Klarfeld, our discipline is to explain everything that's happened in the universe back to the beginning, which was the Big Bang. He says, if you were to ask us what there was a millisecond before the Big Bang, we do not know. If you wish to believe in God, please do, because we don't know where the universe came from.
Mm.
Now, those two answers, I published that in my first book, Adam the Missing Link, direct quotes from these future Nobel laureates, men
yes.
of science. And it made sense to me that these answers were what I was looking for. And then when I discovered my third grade teacher, Linus Zachariah Sitchin, it all came together for me. That's my story.
Wow. Well, you're like a modern-day historian bringing us the truth there. But I have one more question. What about the Ark of the Covenant? Where's that fit in?
Okay, that's one of the great mysteries of King Solomon's Ark of the Covenant. It was purportedly a very powerful device that was used by the Israelites to successfully militarily campaign. It supposedly encased the original Ten Commandments, the tablets, and you couldn't touch it because it would kill you. And
unless you were a Nubian, unless you had dark skin, because it protected against the radiation.
Well, it's a great mystery, and I have not totally, you know, the Ethiopians claim they have it. There are people who claim that King Solomon buried it someplace in the United States. There's all kinds of tales about the Solomon's gold mine and where it was and where the Ark ended up. I really haven't chased that down, and I can't give you an answer.
Right, but was it connected to the Anunnaki as a secret weapon?
Well, they had the technology, certainly, to produce a communication device so that they could talk to Moses through the Ark. That's a very distinct possibility.
Right. So, yeah, do you think religion then basically is sort of a fabricated story where where we've developed these beliefs and ideas that have become obsessions. They've kept us from the truth.
Yes, well, they need a control mechanism, Alan. First, they brought down kingship. Kingship was the original control mechanism. Then they brought down religion. And religion was the second control mechanism. And I think it caused great damage to our civilizations, and that we need to understand that those were mechanisms to control us, and that the religions of the world need to understand where their capital G gods came from and what their purpose was. And once I believe we understand that, we could live together as brothers and sisters of the same species. We don't need to be killing each other.
And do away with religion altogether, really, I mean, in
absolutely.
A sense.
Absolutely. It's, you know, and that's why in the book I'm now writing, I make it as an epilogue to explain my and joint with Zechariah about Yahweh.
But are the Anunnaki still fighting with each other? Is Enlil and Enki, you know, still split?
I imagine that there was a succession that was going to happen. There was they did eventually expire, and Anu, being the king, had to be replaced. And the stories that I get, and this is way out because I'm not a as an engineer, I'm a tire kicker. I need to have facts that I can kick and talk about positively. But this comes from stream of consciousness and people who claim that they're channeling back to Nibiru, and that the succession was given to Enki's son, Ningisada. He was the creator of the Egyptian civilization. He was Thoth in Egypt, and he became Quetzalcoatl in the Americas and created those civilizations. But that he's been elevated to the throne, and therefore the Enki clan apparently is dominant. If that's true, then we're in good shape, because he wanted to save us. He's the one that saved us in the flood.
Mm.
If the other is true, if Enlil's in charge, I'm not so sure that we're going to survive.
Well, let's hope we do survive.
That's my speculation, Alan. This is all speculation on my part. Please.
Of course, of course. Well, I think we're on the road to survival.
I'd like to believe that, too. And I'm hoping that I'm, I'm 86 years old now.
Oh, you're 86. Wow. You're still, lucid and clear and precise and evolving
you.
In your thought. Does this stuff keep you young?
I've been blessed with great genes. I'm really quite pleased with my heritage. And as long as I can keep researching, I'm a reporter. I like to produce the evidence and put it in a format that people can understand easily. And I hope it'll contribute something to our survival.
I think it will. Well, great talking to you, Marshall. Thank you for all the research and information. It puts everything in perspective as far as ancient.
Is there an email address, Alan, that I can send you?
Yes, you can send it to newrealities@earthlink.net. Send me anything you want.
Okay.
Do the grays, the little grays, fit in anywhere in this?
Well, that's another story. Take a little while to explain that.
Okay, we'll do that
for another time. For another time.
Okay, thank you for your time. I look forward to seeing you at Contact in the Desert. That's June 3rd to the 5th and 6th at Joshua Tree, California, Joshua Tree Retreat Center. Go to contactinthedesert.com. And what's your website, Marshall?
It's AdamTheMissingLink.com.
Great. I look forward to seeing you at that UFO Woodstock that we've been going to.
Thank you. I look forward to seeing you too, Alan. And thank you for the interview.
Yeah, thank you. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. And if you want to reach me, go to my website, newrealities.com. Or look me up on YouTube, youtube.com/newrealities. Thanks for listening tonight. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks, Marshall. Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Alan.